Hello, my name is Elle Layton, and I'm a project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm joined here today for an interview with Mayanti Fernando, Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Professor Fernando is visiting Dickinson College to deliver a student-initiated Clark Forum program entitled Muslim France and the Contradictions of La Cité, a History of the Present. Welcome, Professor Fernando.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, so my first question, which you talked about a little bit at lunch, is what made you initially interested in researching the clashes between Muslim French identity and France's secularism?
So it requires a little bit of biography. I was born in Sri Lanka. I lived there till I was 8, and then my mother and I moved to England for 3 years. So I lived in England for 3 years, and when I went to college for my senior thesis project, I decided to work on Muslim communities in Britain. So I did about 3 months worth of field work with a group of young Muslim British women in Bradford. And so I became really interested in questions of religion and politics in Europe. And then when I got to graduate school, I had a professor who really encouraged me not to work on South Asians as a South Asian myself. He thought that it was, and this is a professor named Michel Rolf Trouillot, he thought it was really important for decolonizing anthropology that he sort of thought, you know, the first step of anthropology was like white folks going to study non-white folks, and then the next step of decolonization was having so-called native anthropologists working on their own cultures and their own spaces, and he sort of thought the next step was for non-white anthropologists to do what white anthropologists have done for a very long time, which is to not work on themselves. And so he really encouraged me to work in France. And so so I went to France in the early 2000s and kind of, I spoke French already because I'd grown up in England and I'd gone to school where I'd started learning French. And so my initial research was really about Muslim French and how they were negotiating their identity being Muslim and French. And I worked with a lot of Muslim French communities in France, civic activists and just sort of ordinary people. I worked in a public school. And what became clear and increasingly interesting to me was that most of the young Muslims of North African descent who had been born for the most part and all raised in France saw no contradiction themselves between being French and being Muslim. But obviously the wider society did. And so I became really interested in why people who didn't see any real contradiction between being Muslim and being French were thought of as such a contradiction in terms. And so I sort of turned my analytical gaze, so to speak, back toward, you know, mainstream French society, the French Republic, French secularism, the secular state. So that's the long answer to your question.
No, yes, thank you. So for those listeners unfamiliar, what exactly is laïcité or secularism, if you could define that? And then from thinking from the perspective of an American, how is it ideologically different or similar from freedom of religion?
So laïcité, the most common translation is French secularism. It's a really difficult question in some ways, Ella, like almost impossible to answer in 5 minutes. And that's kind of in some ways what the talk is about. I would say the kind of formal definition is really the separation of church and state and the neutrality of the French state toward religion. And there was a law in 1905 that stipulates that exactly that. I would say that secularism itself is not and never really the separation of church and state, even in the United States, but rather the state, the government making a decision about what is religion and what is not, what is religion, what is politics, and then making a decision about, making a decision about where that line is drawn. So secularism is really a state drawing the line of what constitutes religion and where its proper place is. The way that that line is drawn is different in the United States versus France versus Turkey versus England versus whatever, Denmark, right? But the what makes those states secular is the drawing of that line. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. And so you had asked what's the difference between the United States and France and like what is secularism and what is freedom of religion. I would say that there's no absolute freedom of religion, even in the most secular of, like, I guess that's the thing. There isn't more or less secular. There's just states doing doing secularism differently, drawing that line in different places.
Understood.
Right. And so freedom of religion always, every rights convention, every sort of international convention, European convention, national convention on, you know, human rights and fundamental freedoms is always going to make exceptions for free, like where what freedom is permissible and what is not. Secularism, I would say, a secular state, and the various legal conventions that are attached to these secular states usually make a distinction between the right to conscience and the right to practice or manifest conscience, right? Which is really a distinction between belief and practice, or conscience and practice. And there will, the right to practice or right to manifest, all of these conventions allow those, that right to be abridged or abrogated or whatever, infringed upon in the name of public order. How public order is defined differently in different secular states. So that's kind of what I mean. Like, there is no freedom of religion that is absolute, except perhaps the absolute freedom to believe, right? The right to conscience is inalienable, but it's not clear how it could be, like, violated if, right? Like,
yeah.
In a way, it's not clear, other than, I don't know, brainwashing or something like that.
For sure. For
right.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's a weird right in some ways. The right to conscience is inalienable. Well, what does that mean?
So I had a question about your methodology. As a student senior right now who's interested in conducting ethnographic research with marginalized populations, how did you ensure that you being in these people's lives was both accurate, your findings are both accurate, and then also ethical?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm trying to think how to answer it. In terms of accuracy, I mean, most of my interviews, I tried to get permission to record as much as possible. So really, a lot of the quotations and things like that are literally verbatim. But I think the ethical question is a more complicated one. For me, it was really important that I be myself, like I give an accurate representation of who I was and what my commitments were. And so in some ways with my Muslim French interlocutors, that was easy because I largely had the same kind of political commitments and, you know, commitments to anti-discrimination, et cetera, et cetera, than they did. And I also, a lot of them were activists. And so I joined some of the organizations that they were part of. And so, for instance, I was in France doing kind of active field work between 2002 and 2004, which was the buildup to the 2004 law banning headscarves in public schools. And I also was working in a public school at the time. And everyone knew what my commitments were. I never tried to hide them. I think that's really important. It becomes difficult when you're working with people that you disagree with, but even then it's in some ways even more important. And I would say I also worked with a lot of public school teachers who were, who thought, you know, veiling was a real problem, but they all knew where I stood. Like, we would have conversations about it. We would have discussions and disagreements. And that's really an important, it's both an ethical part of field work, but it's also, it's analytically really important to be able to have these kinds of conversations and these kinds of disagreements. And I would say the same thing with one of the sort of stickier points with some of my interlocutors was around the question of same-sex marriage, right? A lot of them were anti same-sex marriage equality. I was pro, but we were able to talk about it. And in talking about it, I actually came to really understand, like get a better sense of who they were, which seemed important to me analytically as well as an anthropologist. And then lastly, with some of the government officials and bureaucrats and, you know, folks who work for the government that I was also working with, they also knew where I stood. And we had disagreements, but they knew who I was, why I was there. They knew I was an anthropologist. They knew I was writing a book. They knew I was doing, you know, my dissertation. Like, all of that was known. So, and then I think, you know, lastly, the playing field was, like, the sociopolitical playing field is not symmetric. And so for me, it was really important to turn my critique toward the sort of dominant majority, dominant state. But again, I think the big thing is just going, as an anthropologist, always learning from the people that you're talking to and never misrepresenting yourself. The other thing in France was like, one of the trickier things was a lot of my so-called interlocutors became friends, and they remain friends, and they knew, you know, it's like they knew what I was, were they able to read what I was writing? Not necessarily, because it was in English, but I also published some stuff in French. Like, there's a kind of, I don't know, for me it's a great question about voice and ethics, but that's how I would answer that.
Awesome, thank you. In the first section of your book, The Republic Unsettled, Muslim French and the Contradictions of Secularism, you describe a conversation you had with one of your interlocutors who shared her negative experiences trying to pursue higher education while beginning to wear the veil. For unfamiliar listeners, could you describe the shifting populations of, excuse my pronunciation, the banlieues or the outskirts of French cities? And how over generations that created what you call the Muslim French?
Sure. So most of the young people that I was working with were the children, sometimes grandchildren, of immigrants who came, for the most part, from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia, but also sometimes from Senegal or Mali. And that's the thing, you know, we use this term Muslim a lot, but it's not, that doesn't tell you very much, in fact. And so I should really clarify that the population that I was largely working with were French of North African descent rather than Sub-Saharan African or Caribbean or whatever, right? The banlieue in France, like you said, they're sort of outer city suburbs, and they have the term banlieue has the same kind of connotation as like inner city in the United States. Impoverished, public housing, you know, high unemployment, largely non-white. So same sorts of connotations, but just rather than being in the inner city, they're on the outskirts of the city. The population, so I worked mostly in the suburbs of Paris. Starting in the 1950s and 1960s, France imported labor from its North African colonies and former colonies to rebuild after World War II. And a lot of these migrants were, like, they lived in, actually, in the first part of the, like, in shanty towns on the outskirts of Paris and, you know, Marseille, Lyon, etc. And then slowly in the 1970s, there was a period of what was called family reunification. And when France imported this labor in the 1950s and 1960s, they did not expect this labor to stay. But neighbors brought, you know, their wives, they had kids, and so second generation merged in the 1980s and into the 1990s, and that's really the population that I was working with. Now in the banlieue, I worked in between 2002 and 2004 in one of the Parisian banlieues called La Courneuve, which is one of the closer suburbs. And I would say, actually, I mean, it was incredibly diverse. I had students, not just, you know, at this point, kind of grandchildren of North African immigrants, but and children and grandchildren of North African immigrants, but also immigrants from South Asia, East Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, just kind of all over. It was a really, really wonderful and diverse place. I think the banlieue themselves are still changing, right? It's sort of, it's like the place where a lot of recent immigrants go, and then as people start to get more and more settled into France, they move further and further out. But the banlieue still, in Paris, like, they are largely non-white spaces.
Thank you for clarifying. To the next question about your book again, you conclude that these three strategies, critical responsiveness, agnostic respect, and democratic ethos, are necessary to allow the acceptance of Muslim French in the public sphere. First, could you explain what these terms mean? And then second, since your book's publication, has anything shifted in how Muslim French negotiate their beliefs alongside their citizenship?
Wow, this is, I feel like, yeah, I'm being examined on my own book. critical responsiveness, agonistic respect, and democratic ethos, I think, is that toward the end, right, in the conclusion. Yeah, so I kind of talked about all of this in my response to your question about ethics, when I talked about disagreement and the importance of having open conversations, even with people that you disagree with, and then being able to respond to them and to their response, and they respond to your response. You know, it's this sort of back and forth. And what I meant by that was I was really interested in the way that a lot of the folks, the Muslim French, I call them activists, but activists here just mean kind of local community organizing and things like that. How a lot of them were quite politically progressive on certain issues and sort of what we would call in the United States socially conservative on others. And I already talked a little bit about, our disagreements about same-sex marriage. What was really interesting to me was that a lot of the Muslim French that I was working with were like grappling with their own, they were able to ally with non-Muslim organizations on certain things, but not on others. But in not being able to ally on these other things, it put those other things like same-sex marriage into conversation. And so there were like debates amongst a lot of the folks that I was working with about what the response to something like same-sex marriage should be, right? But it was this very kind of like back and forth dialogic process, and people shifted, you know, not everybody, but like people shifted on certain things. And in this process of these different kinds of organizations coming together in the same space on one issue, people started shifting on other issues as well. But what was really striking to me was just that there were a couple of things that were striking. One was sometimes there was the demand that on Muslim associations that they like come out in favor of X, Y, and Z in ways that some of these organizations were like, we can't do that. That's not like we, in part because like we don't actually know where this is a struggle for us. We don't know where we stand. And so that was one of the things I wrote about in my book as well. But the thing that was in some ways like more maybe hopeful, and this is the critical responsiveness, agonistic respect, and democratic ethos, was this like really profound commitment to democracy, to kind of democratic process, and a really profound commitment to working with people that you didn't necessarily agree with all the time. And now in kind of saying that, I'm thinking like, wow, this has real resonances in the present too, right? And that research was like 15 years ago, so things might have really changed. I don't know. But it, for me, just as a person and as someone, like a kind of politically inclined person, it was a real lesson in the importance of working on X, even if you disagreed on Y. And Y, I mean the letter Y. So working on X, even if you disagreed on, you know, S, right? Like you didn't have to... you didn't have to sort of line up all of your political commitments in order to work with another organization.
Interesting.
So that's what I mean by that democratic ethos. And then the critical responsiveness is really just responding. Let's say like you hold a position on X. You're working with someone who's like, I think you're wrong. And here's why. And in working together and having those kinds of disagreements together as you work on something, critical responsiveness is the way in which you respond to that other person and maybe even come around. Not necessarily. The goal is not to come around,
right?
The goal is to just actually have like a real robust, complicated discussion about things. Again, this was a while ago, but that it was something that really struck me about many of the Muslim French civic organizations that I was working with, because they, you know, their allies were not, I mean, many of them were not Muslim, and there were a number of kind of like far left progressive feminist organizations or queer organizations who kind of came out against the 2004 law, and it was. Yeah, I was part of a collective called the One School for All Collective, and it was pretty special, I would say. Yeah.
Follow-up question to that. You saw that really robust dialogue happening amongst activists and everyday citizens. Do you think that could happen at state levels, at national levels? Because that's kind of where like the policy is coming from.
That's a really good question. I don't know, in part because so much of politics now, both in France and the United States, is kind of, a lot of it is grandstanding, right? And there's no room for, like, complicated discussion when you're just grandstanding. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I know this is a conversation about France, but it does... feel like maybe the pendulum can swing back and people are just kind of tired of the grandstanding. It's a great question. I don't know if politics, the political arena, is the space for nuance. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah.
I think that's a sound statement to make. Regardless of the country, yeah.
Well, and it's interesting. I think the higher you go, like in the sense of, I think those kinds of conversations are possible at a local level.
Right.
In a way that they're not at a national level.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. And so I think the bigger question is like, I mean, again, these are kind of my bigger political commitments. I think that real political work has to be done at a local level. And it's also the only level where you can have these kinds of complicated conversations. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. So last semester at the Clark Forum, we had a speaker. Her name was Sahar Sawad, and she talked about the racialization of Muslims in the midst of the so-called global war on terror. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how does this racialization of Muslims fuel stereotypes echoed by French officials about devout Muslims who use their faith as the core of their political activism and civic engagement?
I'm going to kind of answer it obliquely. I think that there's been a kind of unfortunate, like, bifurcation of the study of both Muslim minorities and also the global war on terror, into either it's about racialization or it's about religion, secularism. And I think it's really both. I think there are definitely ways in which the figure of the Muslim is becoming an increasingly racialized figure or trope or whatever you want to call it. Yes. And I think what that means is a kind of essentialization, right? That it's that being Muslim is like more, is about more than just religion. I think the problem with that framework is that it assumes that somehow Muslimness has in the past been only about religion, even for the West. I don't know that that's true. So in some ways, I would argue that the Muslim has always been a figure that is both race and religion. And France is an interesting example because you very much see that in French Algeria, for instance, where terms like Arab, Musulman, Indigène, right, Arab, Muslim, Native, were interchangeable categories. So, in French Algeria, Muslim was both a racial and religious, had racial and religion connotations. So I think part of the problem with the idea that the Muslim is being racialized is that it's not clear to me that the Muslim was ever not racialized. And I think the reason, let's see, the assumption in the discourse of racialization is that the sort of reigning assumption is that it is private and now is being made more than private. But the idea that religion is private is already a secular understanding of religion, I would say, right? So I think that's why they has to be thought about together, race and religion, always, 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 when it comes to the figure of the Muslim. And I would argue with the figure of the Jew. And has been. Like, the Jew has also been both race and religion, right? So I think they're really interesting and complicated. This is a sort of complicated nexus of race and religion. I think what the global war on terror has really done is there's a whole kind of security apparatus now that has, you know, it's a kind of securitization of the figure of the Muslim more than either, because Muslim has always been race and religion, now what we have is this sort of, you know, geopolitical securitization, right? So I think that's, I don't know if I answered your question, but that's sort of how I think about this kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
I took what you said to mean that the Muslim has always been racialized and that with the advent of the global war on terror, it was like the security apparatus was just reflecting these ideological things, beliefs that people already had, it seems.
Right, right. And I think the more, for me, the interesting question too is how in the global war on terror, and this is the case very much in France is kind of a microcosm of this, but how the global war on terror enables both secular Islamophobia and Christian Islamophobia to come together. That's what I find really, I mean, interesting is not the right word, troubling, right. Super problematic, but there's all kinds of really weird ways, right, in which, and this is the case in France, where you could have a kind of Catholic Islamophobia and a secular Islamophobia can find common cause in the figure of the Muslim. And the Catholic is Islamophobic maybe for slightly different reasons, right? I mean, but it's, you know, it's, So that to me is like it's fascinating and really and like really troubling, but you see it in this country as well, right? With kind of the way that that Christian evangelicals can find common cause with Christ, secular Jews, right? Like in the sort of this global war on terror. So the geopolitical part of it, I think the nature of the geopolitical, like the way that this figure of the Muslim is both race and religion gets sort of played out geopolitically the players of that geopolitical game can shift and change in interesting, historically specific ways.
Thank you. Very, very similar question, and apologies if this answer overlaps, but how do you think that the high politicization mm-hmm. of religious veiling, how that discussion is different in France versus in American socio-political contexts, and what the effect does this have on the formation of Muslim identity, if there is a Muslim identity, especially in regards to culture or race, and particularly for young people?
Yeah. Say that one more time, the first part of that question.
How is the highly politicized issue of religious veiling different in French versus American socio-political context?
Mm-hmm. This is not to say that it's necessarily easy to veil in the United States, mm-hmm. But it is, there's ways in which, at least in certain parts of the United States, it's not as, it's not, like, you don't have the full force of the state coming down on you, right? Mm-hmm. You have, like, veiled women in public service positions, like at a bank or, you know, wherever, right? In a way that you don't in France. And so I don't know that veiling is as politicized in quite the same way. I have veiled colleagues at my university. That is not possible in France. Mm-hmm. It's just not. And so in some ways, I think veiling is not, it's like a red herring in some ways, because it's not as if Muslim life is not politicized in the United States. Mm-hmm. It surely is. Mm-hmm. It's just politicized in different ways, right? So I think it's more like, yeah, what's the political context? I mean, we see all kinds of really Islamophobic, you know, legislation in, like, in Tennessee and Texas and in parts of the United States. It's increasingly difficult to build mosques. I mean, there's all kinds of things happening here. I think in some ways, like, mosques have become the focal point in the conversation about Islam in the United States.
The public symbol.
Yeah, is the public, exactly, is the kind of public face of Islam, the public symbol for Islam, versus, you know, like, the veil in France. I also think that I think in the United States, too, the regulation and the carcerality around Muslim life mm-hmm. is so highly linked to the global war on terror and 9/11 and, you know, that sort of moment and its aftermath and the way that civil liberties have been curtailed. It's really been in the service of Islamic radicalism, mm-hmm. so-called Islamic radicalism. In France, you're seeing that more and more and more, but it also there is folded into a politics of immigration and then also politics of integrating second and third generation folks who are already there. So it's like the web is just more complicated, I think, mm-hmm. in France.
Yeah. And it seems it has more to do with, like, the separation from the public and the private life.
Yes. Yeah, I think there's been a way in which the discourse of secularity has really, there's lots of intersections between that and the security discourse in France, I think, in a way that there isn't here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that would be the big difference.
I see.
Right? Like all of that security apparatus is there in France, also justified by, like, the national value of secularism. So we have to get rid of, you know, is these signs of religion in public space is both a contravention of our secular values and potentially signs of radicalization. Whereas I think here it's like radicalization.
All right. This concludes our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you again for sitting down and having this conversation with me.
Sure. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you, Professor.